Shalom Aleichem, everyone. Thank you for coming on to the conference call this afternoon, Erev Rosh Chodesh. And I'd like to thank everybody Willig as well for being on this afternoon. Just one, actually two announcements. This is not an anonymous conference call, so we hope you announced yourself as you enter the call. Also, please, we just heard some difficult news that Rabbi Emanuel Gettinger of the Young Israel of the West Side is not feeling well, and I just want everyone to be aware of the fact he's the founding Rav of the Israel of the West Side. So please keep in mind in your tefillos, it's Menachem Ben Sarah. I am now going to put everyone on mute other than Rabbi Willig and myself, and that will take another half second, and then we can begin. Please bear with me 1 second, please. Rabbi, are you still online? You hear me?
I'm online. Yeah.
Okay, we're ready to begin, please.
Okay. I agreed to address follow-up questions at the very beginning. There is one follow-up question which I believe everyone here has received. It has to do with the question we spoke about last week, who should get Aliyos. And the question is, what happens is a shul where one does not have to be concerned with the regular members, totally Shomer Shabbos. Could it then be more permissible to allow the rare non-Shomer Shabbos person to have an aliyah? Is not allowing an aliyah to such a person an issue of Kavod HaTzibur, in which case perhaps he should not get an aliyah, or in setting up Gedar for a community, in which case it may not matter? That's the question. Excellent question. I believe that both of the reasons that were given are correct, and therefore it would be preferred that such an individual should not get an aliyah. However, as we spoke last time, there can be various additional calculations based upon the audience, based upon the particular individual. We have this concept called a shas hatzchak. Given the audience and given the particular person, it may be worthwhile to give such an individual an aliyah if he asks for one, or especially if he has some kind of a yartzeit, etc. So obviously, whenever we're dealing with a shas hatzchak, we have to take the full range of considerations in mind. And here, the point which is just brought up, namely, the person is a just an occasional guest, and the reason of kavod hatzibur is the only reason. The gedarim reason does not apply. There's not just some more room to be lenient in such circumstances. Once again, depends upon the judgment of the Rav, taking the whole picture into account. This is a follow-up. Now we have new shaylos. We have a total of 5, if I'm not mistaken, although there were some additions to 2 of the questions, the first one and the fifth one, first and last. Let us now read question number 1. Please address the issue of going to a water park, men and women together. Should the Rav be proactive before vacation season and say something publicly? The addition to the question is, what about joining co-ed gyms, particularly in locales where there is no single-sex option available? That may be different than water parks due to the health benefits involved. That's the question. Here's the answer. The prohibition of mixed swimming, going to the beach, is not the swimming itself. Rather, it is the problem of what we call in our language histaklus, of gazing upon women who are improperly clad. Today's typical beach wear is very, very scanty, and it reveals parts of a woman's body that the man should not be looking at. The Gemara tells us in the Sechta Baba Basra, at the end of the third parak, based on the pasuk of Otsem Einav Meros Vara, that a man should not walk by an area where the women are doing the laundry, because they would lift up their skirts, and he would see parts of her body that he should not see otherwise. And they say, if there's another way, a dark achrina, he's required to go on that other path. Otherwise, Chalila V'chas, he's labeled a Rasha. If he goes the way where he's going to see things, which he didn't have to because he had an alternative. If they were worried about the small amount that was revealed when the women picked up their skirts not to get wet and doing the laundry by the riverside, how much more so in the case of a water park, for those who are unaware, I did some homework myself on what a water park is. Basically, the women dress at a water park as they do at the beach. They go all kinds of water slides and rides. It's the more or less beach wear. And therefore, since so much is exposed in today's world, it's not right for a man to be there. Not only is he not going on another way, which you'd be required to by the Gemara Baba Basra, but he's bedafka, going to this park where there's no need for him to go. In the case of the Gemara, he has to get from place A to place B. So the shortest way may be to go past where the women are doing their laundry. He's supposed to go out of the way, to some extent, to avoid seeing what he would otherwise see. Kavachomer, you shouldn't go into a water park. The water park is not, no need for an individual to go there. So therefore, I believe that it's a very serious violation to go to a water park, men and women together. And you have to do everything you can to avoid it. Now, the next part of the question was, should the Rav be proactive before vacation season and say something publicly? This is the most difficult question for any Rav to answer. And more generally, we'll have to come back to this at the end. What should a Rav say, and what should he not say? I've been struggling with this for a long time on so many issues. You can make a mistake in either direction. If you say something which will not be heard at all, so you haven't accomplished much. Very often, it could lead to an ignoring of your other statements. Sometimes it can lead to individuals sinning on a higher level of sin because they know it's prohibited than otherwise. And so sometimes, as the Gemara tells us, the mitzvah shaloloma davashen anishma. Riff talks about it over there. He shouldn't be saying too many things on the one hand. On the other hand, if a Rav, who's a spiritual leader in the community, has an opportunity to be mocha, and is not mocha, chas v'chalila, he can be nitzvah and not sin himself, like Gemara Masechta Shabbos. So there are conflicting points, and it's up to the Rav to reach some kind of a decision, either by himself or in consultation. What should he do? Should he speak or should he not speak? The Chazal have an expression, oilim oma, oilim lo oma. It's sometimes you don't know if it's I should speak or I shouldn't speak. I can't tell anyone a Rav what to do in his own community. I don't know the Rav, I don't know the community. I can only speak for myself. In my shul, every summer, the month of June, I have my, but the people already know it's coming because it comes every year. In one form or another, someone always manages to get into the parasha somehow or other, or some other event. My tznia speech, which I speak to the men by watching what they see, and the women watching what they wear. And it's irrelevant, you know, where it is, going into a water park, you shouldn't go in the first place. Certain other vacation spots should be avoided, or if they are frequented, it must be done with proper dress, and especially for men, if the women around are not dressed properly, they should do their best to avoid it. Now, you'll tell me, what about walking in the streets of New York City in the summertime? It's a problem, not denying it. The person who could find a way to go seeing less is required to do so based on blah, 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 blah. If there's no alternative, he has to get to his office, he has to make a living. So then if there's no alternative, there's no alternative. So he should try to be otzemeinav as much as possible to avoid seeing things that he shouldn't be seeing. You know, we just lost the great tzaddik, Abavad Yosef. I just read in Hamayan, came to my mail this week, that Abavad Yosef said he was blessed with a phenomenal knowledge of Torah because he was always careful in the Shmira Sinai. Such a great man makes such a statement. It's just a lesson for all of us and for all of our congregants. This area of life, which is unfortunately completely ignored in certain parts of our society, meaning American society for sure, Jewish society, unfortunately, and even part of Torah society, we have to be strong in whatever we can do. Again, if you say too much, it's going to backfire. But to say nothing at all seems to me to be a terrible mistake. We all know about these days, it's not just the question of the live vision in the water parks and the beaches, etc., but there's also the cyberspace, the internet, and all the unfortunate issues of pornography that unfortunately even members of the film community are entrapped in. Even certain people whose first name is Rabbi have been known to fall into this trap because it's right in front of your nose. It used to be you had to go to a store to buy the stuff. It was embarrassing. Now it's in the privacy of your internet, and you press a button, it even pops up at you. Extra care is needed in our generation to be careful. So therefore, this issue, again, the water park to me is an open and shut issue which should not be done whatsoever. Whether the Rav should speak about it or not, and how we should speak about it, that obviously depends on every Rav and every community. I want to address the second part of the question, the additional part about co-ed gyms. What distinction is made here between health benefits? That's not the main distinction. The main distinction is in terms of the facts of the situation. Generally speaking, of course, there are exceptions. Generally speaking, the lack of tznius in a co-ed gym is much, much, much less than it is in a water park. Generally speaking, women who come to exercise seriously, they're dressed, yes, they're dressed in tight-fitting clothes, which is not ideal, but it's a far cry from the absolute revealing clothing or lack thereof that pervade in water parks. Now, in addition, if a person is going to a gym, obviously for purposes of health, we heard about health, so then the person should be focusing and concentrating on, you know, what he or she is doing. Specifically, his status is primarily a man's problem. There are certain issues for women as well. So if the man is focused on his treadmill or whatever machine he is using in the particular gym, he's able to tune out what's going on around him. And thereby, because of that focus and concentration, not to be distracted and chalilah aroused by seeing things around him which he shouldn't be seeing. That's much more difficult than a leisurely, recreational kind of a setting of a water park. Having said that, it's certainly required for anyone who has the ability to find a single-gender gym to do so. But still, there is some measure of priestess in a gym. You are absolutely required to do it if there's any alternative whatsoever. Based on the Gemara we said before, in the Sechta Baba Basra. The only question, as was mentioned here, is there's no alternative in locales where there's no option. If there is an option, you're required to take it. No option. So then we can take into account the consideration of health and say, look, health is important, and the doctor says you have to go to the gym, and there's no alternative. So you go and you close your eyes to what's going on around you, and hopefully the person will not be involved in any inappropriate behavior. I must say at this juncture that this applies to the gym itself, going to the gym to get the proper exercise, which is good for the health. There's a phenomenon today called a personal trainer. Absolutely prohibited for one to have a personal trainer of the opposite gender. Unfortunately, this has led to the most horrific violations, adultery, and everything else. It's a disaster. And no one should say that I'm above it, it doesn't affect me. Chas v'chalila. That's where a line has to be drawn, an absolute line. But again, without that, if it's just a matter of a co-ed gym and there's no alternative, and it's for health purposes, the individual should be told it may be done if full concentration is put on the exercise and every effort is made to avoid seeing things that, according to halacha, should not be seen. This is question number one. Question number two. I quote, doing activities together with a conservative synagogue, and joining a board of rabbis that includes rabbis of all denominations. Take the second one first. Why is one joining a board of rabbis that includes rabbis of all denominations? What's the reason for doing so? So many, many years ago, there was a need to join something called the New York Board of Rabbis, a local institution here in the city of New York, in order for an individual to receive employment, to gain employment in certain positions. Chaplaincies were a prime example. Your application couldn't even be processed without a membership in New York Board of Rabbis. And this is a serious parnassah issue. And my understanding is that my Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, was lenient in this regard. He did not view this as giving any endorsement or legitimacy to non-Orthodox rabbis. It's just a matter of joining an employment group in order to be able to receive employment. He was not opposed to that, to the best of my knowledge. And, you know, the fact that someone else goes by the name Rabbi and you call him by that name, I don't think that's a problem. If someone goes by the title Rabbi in Reform or Conservative or Reconstructionist, whatever it may be, I don't believe it's a problem in calling him by that name, because that's the name that he goes by in his group. That's how he's known. So if you call someone a doctor, call someone a rabbi, the person has the title that he goes by, I do not view that as a problem. If a person joins a board of rabbis in order to be able to discuss religious matters, Torah and Psak Halacha, I believe it's completely inappropriate, because the rabbis of the non-Orthodox denominations do not accept the basic postulates of halachic discourse as we know them. And therefore, I believe that such interaction is not appropriate and should be avoided if it's at all possible. Now, I'm, again, speaking from a New York perspective. Someone that's out of town may find himself in an almost unavoidable situation of joining some of these boards. Can't judge for someone else's circumstances. If it's absolutely necessary, then once again, you're not making a choice. You're, in effect, forced into such a situation. The fact that there's no choice is itself a reason to give some kind of dispensations if necessary. It should be very clear that you're not joining in order to discuss matters of religion, of Torah, of mitzvahs. This is not what it's all about, and we shall see in a moment. These groups should be used for outside activities, helping in hospitals and helping in the Jewish community in its interactions with people beyond the Jewish people, things of this nature. Now, this particular distinction between internal and external was formulated by my Rebbe of Soloveitchik, Zichrono Livracha, in this kind of a context as well. And his famous phrase was Kalape Chutz versus Kalape Pnim. This can be found in the book by Rabbi Louis Bernstein about the Rabbinical Council of America, Challenge and Mission. It's quoted in Tradition of the summer edition of 1996. By Rav Meir Twersky Shlita on page 100, and it's important. He felt that to protect ourselves, klape chutz, when we interact with the non-Jewish world, then we have to interact with others. So be it. This is relevant in the day of the Soviet Jewry movement. It's still relevant in the pro-state of Israel. Lobby. These are issues of pikuach nefesh, where Jewish lives are at stake, and in such circumstances, there may be an appropriate role for joining together to do certain things. Again, depends on the time and the place, the circumstances. However, what he called kalape pnim, in internal matters, fundamentally religious matters, learning Torah, doing mitzvahs, the groups are what you would call incommensurate. There's no common ground between the Orthodox and the non-Orthodox, and therefore we should not be joining with them. So the question, to go back to it from the beginning, is doing activities together with a conservative synagogue. The word activities is extremely vague. It could be many things. An activity might be, you know, protesting against those who want to attack the state of Israel any which way. That might be something which is appropriate. If it involves Torah discussions, and generally fraternization between groups, whether it be of rabbis or balabatim. Remember, the question is doing activities, not just a matter of rabbis. Second part is rabbis. Rabbis have a better sense to know, to discern that they're joining a board to make sure that you know, the city government, for example, looks upon Jewish interests favorably, things of this nature. But once you get to balabatim, who don't have this same sense of discernment, have to be even more careful, I believe, to avoid any formal activities together with a conservative synagogue, which are not absolutely connected to what we call, the Rav called kolap echutz, to protecting Jewish interests against those who come from outside and wish to harm us. This was the Rav's opinion in his day, and I believe that it is absolutely the proper approach today as well. There are those who are saying times have changed. I don't know. It seems to me that there should be a clear border between Orthodox and non-Orthodox. And a conservative synagogue, by definition, is non-Orthodox. And there should be a boundary, a clear boundary. My personal view is that a conservative synagogue in the community is not the place where the Orthodox rabbi belongs under any circumstances. That's my personal view. If there have to be these, you know, protect the state of Israel or protect the people of Israel from anti-Semitism, these kind of things, they should be held at a neutral site, a Y, a Federation, or perhaps even an Orthodox synagogue if the others don't work, but not in a non-Orthodox synagogue. That, in my view, is it should be out of bounds. I'm not discussing never, ever walking into such a place, or Moshe has a tshuva about weddings in such venues. And he says it's permissible unless a person is an Adam Choshev, and people will learn from him. To my mind, it largely depends upon the custom of the Orthodox rabbinate in that particular place. If I'm asked to do a wedding in a few communities not far from me where the local rabbis regularly go into the conservative or even reform synagogue / temple for weddings, bar mitzvahs, etc., I don't believe I have to be more strict than the local rabbis. They've decided not to draw the line before that point, so I'm coming as an outsider, and I'm following the rulings of the local rabbis. I think that is appropriate. If the local rabbis don't want to go in there and don't go in there, I don't think I should go there as well. If I'm called upon to go to some kind of a funeral, that's the most common case, in a faraway place, not in my own hometown, whether it be for a congregant or a relative, etc., I would do it, but as a private citizen, I'm not co-officiating with any members of non-Orthodox clergy. I'm just sitting in the back, listening to whatever eulogies are being said. That's a common case, but in my own community, I wouldn't do it. The Rav Zichrono Livracha once wanted to attend the funeral of someone who was extraordinarily helpful to him, a tremendous hakaras hatov, but within a conservative shul. I have it from a member of the family that he felt he couldn't go in, and it was, but he had to be there, and it was raining. He stood outside for an hour under an umbrella outside the steps to pay respects to the person who had helped him, Karas Atov, but he wouldn't walk in. Now, we're not as great as the Rav, but, you know, still in our own communities, if it can be avoided, that is my preference. Obviously, that's how the Rav conducted himself, despite a pressing situation. I'm not speaking to the whole world. In some communities, they're unable to draw that line, and I appreciate that. But I think that if that line can be drawn, that's the proper place to do it. Unfortunately, there are seem to be many individuals who, for whatever reason, are not following these guidelines. Sometimes you find that Orthodox rabbis and congregations are not just dealing with issues we'll call them protecting Jewish interests in the strictest sense of the word, by interacting with outside, with the police, with the diplomats, with the government, things of this nature. But even in internal discussions, which of course by definition are informed by some kind of a Jewish tradition, I don't think the Jewish tradition of Orthodox and non-Orthodox is compatible. And how much more so if these rabbis are appearing together and in a conservative synagogue and on a Shabbos and they're eating together. This to me is a violation of the Rav's guidelines, which in my opinion are absolutely appropriate today as they were when the Rav articulated them so many years ago. This is question number two. Question number three. Should the Rav encourage his congregants to vote for political candidates whose outlook on moral issues are more in consonance with those of halacha, or is it something that a Rav should not get involved in? You and I both know that there are many political rabbis who are deeply involved in with various candidates. In my opinion, it's yotza schora b'hafseda. Maybe gain something, but I think the loss is greater than the gain. I would think it's prudent to avoid all such involvement. I should caution you that there may even be certain legal implications if a particular candidate is endorsed by a particular rabbi in a congregation. It may endanger the tax exempt status of the organization and all of the congregants who've donated. Be very careful and speak to experts about that. Now, the moral issues themselves are, of course, very, very important. And the rabbis should be focused on moral issues. And, you know, maybe a person will hear the rabbi's emphasis on a particular moral issue and will put two and two together, come to the conclusion that based on what the rabbi said about a particular moral issue, maybe I should vote to candidate A and not to candidate B. And we'll call him Maven Yovin. Okay, there's nothing wrong with that. But the direct involvement with political candidates, I believe, is a serious mistake on many grounds. Number one, if the candidate loses, the other candidate has it in for you and can calm the community. Chalila. Number two, even if the candidate wins, sometimes they may feel that there is a connection between the candidate and the rabbi and the community. You can get dragged into certain things, positions that this politician has no choice but to take, which do not agree with your way of looking at things. We talk about moral issues. There are many, many moral issues. And he can maybe more in consonant with those of halacha, but not completely. So if you endorsed him and became involved with him, then even the smaller infractions of what we'll call today moral issues are attributed to you as a supporter of this politician, which is not good. So that's why I believe that rabbis should stick to their mandate. Their mandate is a mandate of Torah and Tefillah and Chesed, and leave politics to others. Again, I can't speak for everyone. In certain communities, it's maybe critical for the Rabbonim to involve themselves somehow or other with political candidates. I know in some places, the rabbi puts up on the board who he voted for, and people follow suit and vote en bloc. That's how the Hasidim do it, and it's helpful to them. They have so many votes that the candidate will provide them with services in order to be the beneficiary of these votes, and they vote en bloc. You can check it out on the computer. Everyone in this neighborhood voted the same way. So that's an effective tool, and I'm not here to discredit it completely. Most people on this call do not have that kind of a bloc voter ability, and especially in those cases, I think it's appropriate to stay away from political activity or endorsing any candidates. Again, the issues themselves, not only can, but should be addressed. And if it leads to an individual to reach a conclusion to vote for A and not for B or vice versa, then that's good as well. Okay, now question number 4. A fellow in his 60s who teaches secular studies in a local day school has been progressively becoming more and more religious. Daven each day, won't drive or do malach on Shabbos, keeps kosher. Problem is, his non-Jewish wife of 40 years, with whom he has a very good marriage, is completely not interested. Should the Rav encourage his continued religious growth that may or may not break up his marriage? The answer is absolutely. Absolutely, the Rav should encourage his continued religious growth. Not even a question. What are you worried about? He's going to divorce his wife? Oh, just look at Sefer Ezra. Oh, a major part is devoted to the fact that Ezra was able to prevail upon the Jewish men to, in fact, divorce their non-Jewish wives. We do not believe in intermarriage. So in this particular case, you worry about breaking up the marriage. That's an extra bonus. We don't believe in permissibility of intermarriage. Of course, the questioner is very careful. That may or may not break up his marriage. I believe this to mean that perhaps a bigger problem if it does not break up his marriage, and there will be confusion in the house because the marriage is still, you know, going forward, and the husband is becoming observant, and the wife wants no part of it. So, listen, you can't tell a fellow that he doesn't want to divorce his wife, so therefore he's not required to keep the other areas of halacha. Living with a non-Jewish woman is a very serious aveira. The Rambam writes in Luchasis Rabia that don't think because it's the punishment is not as strong as other violations in this area. That's not considered so serious. No, it's very, very serious. It's a marriage, especially between a Jewish man and a non-Jewish woman, is chayav koreis with divrei kabbalah. The kids aren't Jewish, as you all know. Very, very, very serious problem. And if it were up to us, we would break up all such marriages. I'm aware of the idea of conversion. Conversion is a possibility. If indeed the woman really accepts upon herself the mitzvahs that will actually keep them, that's always an option to be kept in mind. But to say I'm not going to teach this fellow anything because he's married to a non-Jewish woman, I don't believe that's the correct approach. The story goes that someone who converted to another religion came to visit the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon said that he should wash the Tefillah Sidayim before he eats bread. So they asked Rebbe, fellows in the church, he's outside the religion. They say, why are you insisting on the Tefillah Sidayim? As the story is printed, the Vilna Gaon said, listen, after this man has 120 years, he's going to go up to Shemayim, and they're going to judge him on everything. The fact that he's going to be judged big time on his intermarriage does not relieve him of his responsibility to wash the tefillah sedayim for a piece of bread. If he doesn't do it, he's going to get punished for that as well. That kind of attitude informs our present question. He says a lot of religious growth. We'd like to encourage his religious growth. He may decide he can't, not strong enough to pull himself away from his wife for 40 years, and she's not willing to convert, or won't convert seriously. So that's his decision, which he'll have to answer for. But if you are contributing to a spiritual growth, and as we said before, wash the tefillah sedayim, he'll make brachas, he'll daven, he'll keep Shabbos, keep kosher. That's a wonderful improvement. So you should do the best you can to improve his spiritual life. And as far as his non-Jewish wife, so there's three choices. Either he will divorce her, or he will stay with her, or she can convert. As the case may be, either way, it should not deter you from being very straightforward, and you're discussing these matters with this kind of individual. That's question number 4. now the last question is question number five. Question five is the last one is always the hardest. I read it. I am now in my third year of being a rabbi in a shul and feel that I have a good relationship with my balabatim, so much so that they would like to renew my contract. So far, so good. Written in my first contract, this is a Pella, is an agreement that I signed that will not change any of the minhagim zmanim of the shul. Should I, in contract number two, insist this be taken out for the sake of the shul minyan? The shul davens Shachris, Shabbos morning at 9 a.m. has only one Shabbos morning minyan. Congregants have been leaving in the minyan to daven earlier at 8 a.m. or 8:30 minyan. Even with a 10-minute rush and faster landing and davening, we are still the latest shul to finish in our community. What would you suggest? That's the fifth and final question. This, of course, has a follow-up regarding question five. Bichlal, at what point is it appropriate for a new rabbi to adjust practices, Ben Lekula, Ben Lechumra, to reflect his own views of what is appropriate for that particular congregation? So let us speak about the general idea first, and then we'll come to the particular. I'd like to refer you to the sefer of my rabbi, Rav Shach, the Shalita, called the Ikveh Hatzon. The Ikveh Hatzon, in Simon Yud Beis, which starts on page Nun Ches and ends on page Samach, it's two pages. Rav Shechter Shalita addresses an issue of what is attributed to the local rabbi, rabbi of the shul, and what could be considered simply a carryover of earlier practices. The example that he gives, and we're talking here as the second part of the question was, the kula and the chumra in general, an eruv the previous rabbi thought was kosher, and he thinks that there's a problem. So Rav Shechter writes, he's not required to fix the eruv the first week he arrives, and he's not considered a quote machshelus rabbim beisa tiltul. He's causing them to violate something which is serious, kind of not an appropriate Erev. As long as the Erev is kosher, let him mixas deus. I feel yachid b'makom rabim. This is one opinion that permits certain leniencies with respect to an Erev. For the first part of the rabbi's tenure in his community, it's not his Erev. It's the previous rabbi's Erev. But then, and here I quote, avali acha shekvan shoa b'kilosos man rav. He's been in this community for a long time. The Balabatim Lino Koros of Shalom. The Balabatim are going to follow his psokim, Ben Hoka Ben Lahachmir. Then it's also for the Rav to let the Erev stay as it was earlier, because he feels that it's his Erev, his town now. As if he's giving, quote, a Hechsher or Gushpanka, which is impossible if he thinks it's substandard. You have to fix up the Erev. Can't just allow it to exist based on previous rabbis' rulings. So generally, when a person walks into a shul, we'll call it a certain honeymoon period, which he can say, listen, these practices are not my own. They're from the previous rabbi who introduced them to the community before me. But then, as Rav Shechter formulates at the end, ul'acha kama shanim, after a number of years, then the rabbi has to make his own opinions known. And the Balabatim presumably will be able to follow his new rulings, because he's the new Rav. This is what we call Bigadol in general. It's found in Siman Yud Beis of the Sefer Bikvei Hatzon by Harav Shechter Shalita. So let's try to apply that to the situation at hand. A rabbi walks into a shul and they're davening at 9 o'clock. And they insist in a contract, believe it or not, he can't change any of the minhagim with his manim of the shul. Okay? So, obviously, if he signed a contract, he's bound by the contract. There's nothing to talk about. This issue is, of course, a halachic issue, as we shall explain, and it's also a practical issue. People leaving the shul because they want to finish earlier. Obviously, there's some people who are a little lazy. They'd like to sleep till 9 o'clock minyan. What is the halachic issue here? It's very often at Zman Kriya Shema Yeshua here in New York City. If you daven at 8:30 these days, you can make Zman Kriya Shema of the Vilna Gaon all year long. If you daven at 9 o'clock, you miss it most of the time. So that half an hour is absolutely critical from that perspective. And also, as the rabbi is asking here, that it keeps the davening starting late and ending late, and people are leaving the shul over these things. That's the question, what should the rabbi do? So, going back to the model, which we learned from Rav Shechta, you have to understand that initially you come into a shul and they're davening it at 9 o'clock, and they put it into the contract, so you're bound by the contract. The contract is up. Obviously, you're there a couple of years. And the question is now, they want to sign a new contract. If the individual can approach the committee who comes to talk to them about contract and say, listen, the first contract I signed, not to change anything. And the reason I did it is because, you know, that was a precondition for my job. No one knew who I was. People were afraid I'd be completely radical in whatever I want to do. So they want to make sure to preserve a certain measure of status quo, transitioning from one rabbi to the other. Now it's a few years later, you know who I am. I'm not so radical. You've gotten to know me. I've gotten to know you. I think this should be taken out of the contract and give me more ability to adjust things as I see fit. Did the Baal HaBatim say, absolutely not. We are a sleep late Shabbos morning shul, and we insist on putting it back into the contract a second time. I believe it's permissible for the rabbi to sign this contract a second time, but it's unfortunate because shuls should be willing to accept the rulings of their current rabbi. Einecha el shofet should be a mecha, and it's not appropriate for them after getting to know the rabbi for a few years to insist that this clause be reinserted into a contract. That's what I think. If they insist on it, don't believe the rabbi is required to quit a job over this. I think he can stay on longer. And the hope that after a few more years, they'll realize that the rabbi is now the rabbi. And what the previous rabbi said, it's becoming more and more irrelevant. It's not appropriate to tie the rabbi up in knots that he can't change A, B, or C. It's because the previous rabbi introduced certain things, especially if there's a halachic component, which would incline towards making certain changes. Having said that, here again, to go back to our first question, as I said we would, what the rabbi says and does not say is very much a question of judgment in a case-by-case situation. In some cases, the rabbi can be strong and say such and such things. Others, he can't. It's not going to work. The rabbi has to make an honest evaluation, look in the mirror, and say, do I have the ability to make such statements in this particular case? Or maybe I really don't, and I should just say nothing. Obviously, I can't judge any particular case. I'll tell you this, my own story. This month, Baruch Hashem, I'm celebrating 40 years in the Young Israel of Riverdale. I came to the shul. The shul was davening 9 o'clock on Shabbos morning. The first thing I did was change to 8:30. I did it for a variety of reasons, most of them halachic in nature. But also, I felt, you know, daven all week long at 6:30 or 7, they can daven at 8:30. They don't need to sleep that much later. It's unhealthy. Davening starts later and ends later. It's just not appropriate. What's the halacha consideration? Halacha consideration is primarily sof zman kriya shma. It says in the poskim, when a person is supposed to say kriya shma bizmana al seder habrochus, so much so that many poskim, even I believe the Vilna Gaon, suggests that if a shul davens too late and misses his zman kriya shma, that the individual shouldn't daven shachris in the shul, should daven at home with kriya shma at the right time, and then come to shul later for kedusha. That's an unfortunate reality. It has to exist. When I came, as I said, I changed it from 9 to 8:30 with that in mind, but there were many weeks at that time that 8:30 didn't quite make it. They moved the clock then, so about 40 years ago, at the end of April, and the very end of April, Sovzman Kriyashma was before 8:30. By the time they started, he already missed his man. So you make announcements that you should make sure to say Kriyashma before you come to shul, because I wasn't in a position at that time to change things more dramatically than I did, and I understood that. As years went by, and the shul got used to me, that's what I wasn't, didn't have any horns, but at the same time I had certain halachic preferences, some of them very strong, I gradually started to explain to the Balabatim how important it is that we should daven bizman, and we should say Kriya Shema bizman. Otherwise, some people wouldn't say Kriya Shema at all in its right time. Others would say it earlier before they come to shul, but wouldn't be saying the Shema with the brachas together. And that's a very serious consideration, according to everybody. According to some, it goes so far as to override Tefillah B'Tzibur. So after some years, that's what we did. And we were able to, I won't say, can't say exactly how many years it was. I would say probably, I don't know, because within the first 10 years of my being here, we were able to accomplish this, that we would daven as early as it took to make this Zman Kriya Shema. Those who remember, Sof Zman Kriya Shema was 8:28, the end of April here in New York City then. So we have to daven Shacharis at 10 to 8 in the morning in order to be able to reach Kriya Shema, and ideally to reach the Gaul Yisrael and Shmoneh Esrei, which according to the Gra may be required, before Sof Zman Kriya Shema. There was some opposition. Thank God I was able to prevail. People actually came after me to try to get me to change my mind. But thankfully, Congress changed its mind before I had to change mine. And now, if you daven at 8:30, you can make Zman Kriya Shema every single week of the year. You have to hustle a couple of weeks. The beginning of November, the beginning of March, just after, just before the clock has changed respectively. But it still can be done. I think that's the ideal thing to do. If you can't change it to 8:30, I understand that. There are many great shuls and great rabbis, much, much greater than myself, who never insisted on this change. They felt it wasn't worth it for them to try to push for it. They would lose more than they would gain. I'm not here to judge them. I do say that the idea of a contract where the rabbi is forbidden to change certain things is not an appropriate contract. I mean, the person signed it the first time, he had no alternative, and he may not have any alternative the second time as well. But hopefully the next time around, they'll come to their senses, give the rabbi more wiggle room. At the same time, Rabbanim should realize that they don't have free rein to change every single meeting of the shul based on what they think is the best. There is an issue of old minhagim should not be overturned that easily. When I came to my shul, so the shul has a minhag, as many Ashkenaz shuls have, to make kiddush on Friday night. And I said, you know, where I come from, I came from a shtiebel, they didn't do it, and the yeshiva, they didn't do it, and Eretz Yisrael, they didn't do it. And I was saying, maybe we should consider following the minhag of others. Leave out the Kiddush. I got a very strong pushback from the Balabatim, especially the Yekesh of Balabatim. That's part of the minhag of the basic Knesset. And I realized that they're right. That even though that might not be my personal preference, but if that's the minhag of the shul, and it has certainly gedolim to rely upon, even though the Shulchan Aruch himself was opposed, the Rama favors it. And I believe that I was a young Turk at the time. I wanted to start playing with such minhagim, and I was told, and I think correctly, that you can't play with these minhagim. These are old minhagim, not just newfangled stuff. The minhag still stands to this day, and on the rare occasions that I'm the Baal Tefillah on Friday night or on Yontif, I make Kiddush. Rav Moshe has a tshuva about this as well, that even a person who thinks that the bracha is inappropriate has the right to make that bracha if it's done in the context of the tzibur. This shows the power of a community minhag, which again has a source. I'm discussing something which is based on a completely incorrect minhag. The Rabbeinu Tam said in castigating a certain minhag that, you know, minhag, you spell it backwards, instead of mem nun hey gimel, is gimel hey nun mem. I'll tell you what that pronounce that. Not a good place to be. So you have to know what minig is simply incorrect, has no basis. What's a minig which has a basis, at least b'di'evit, a talmid chacham of note, of stature, felt should be allowed to stay in place, even if their own personal preference would not have been in that direction. This completes question number 5, and I have about 5 minutes to go. Rabbi Hammy can tell me if I should answer other questions or get off the phone early.
I think we can give Rabbi a break. And thank you for your time on the phone. Bezrat Hashem, we'll be in touch with the Chevra of when our next conference call will be. Right now, we've done it every other week. We hope to continue in that direction as well.
So thanks a lot. If the people on the phone want to hear me in 2 weeks from now and submit questions before that, believe that, I'm happy to try to continue this. And I appreciate the, silence which is being imposed on the individuals listening to this call. I'm frankly uncomfortable speaking in a monologue into a telephone. I'm used to staying shiur, which is very interactive. Meeting are arguing with me, commenting all the time. I'm told that given the particular format that's being used, that wouldn't work. And I apologize for the form, which again is not my ideal form. But I hope that individuals who continue to listen in are gaining something from the questions and the answers. Thank you very much.
Yeshua, take care.